This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, where I go deep with the artists, activists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, businessmen, and visionaries who are making the world more libertarian, or at least more interesting, by challenging worn-out ideas and orthodoxies. Today's guest is Jeff Flake, the former Arizona senator, U.S. ambassador to Turkey, and now head of the brand new Institute of Politics at Arizona State University. Flake made national headlines in 2017 when he delivered a searing Senate floor speech announcing that he would not seek re-election and declaring that he would not be complicit in the degradation of our politics under Donald Trump and MAGA. A lifelong conservative with libertarian leanings, Flake built his career on defending free markets, free trade, limited government, and pro-immigration policies. These were positions that put him at odds with the Republican Party, drifting out of the Tea Party and toward raw populism and protectionism. We talk about why he chose principle over power and whether he still feels comfortable with that choice. His time representing the U.S. and Turkey as Russia invaded Ukraine, his push for reforming America's broken political system, and why he believes the fever of grievance politics on the right and the left must end and eventually will. Here is the Reason interview with Jeff Flake. Jeff Flake, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's great to talk to you, Nick.
We are at Arizona State University in Tempe. Am I pronouncing that right?
Tempe.
Tempe,
yeah,
Arizona, where you've got, as the logo behind you shows, an Institute of Politics. We're going to talk about what you're doing there and what you hope to accomplish. But first, I want to travel back almost a decade to October of 2017, when you gave a really substantial speech on the floor of the Senate, talking about why you were not going to be running for re-election. And you talked about how you said, "I will not be complicit in the degradation of our politics," that the what was going on, particularly coming out of the MAGA movement and the Trump movement, was not normal. You said there was a moral rot in our politics. Just yesterday, and we're talking on the end of September, hours before a possible government shutdown. We don't know if it'll happen or not. And Donald Trump has tweeted out a video of Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, the leaders of the Democrats in the House and the Senate. Hakeem Jeffries has a sombrero, you know, put on his head, and Chuck Schumer, it's a fake voice talking about how, you know, nobody wants to be a Democrat anymore, but they're bringing in illegal immigrants who will vote for the Democrats because they're stupid, et cetera. You know, you're not complicit in that, I guess, but like, what's your response to, you know, the president acting like that?
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about in 2017. And I couldn't be a part of it. I knew that in order to win re-election, and, you know, I'd just come to the Senate. I was in my first term. Yeah. Anybody who gets to the Senate wants to spend more than one term.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
the most
you want to be carried out
club
of there.
In the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would have liked to have run again. But the price to be paid, in my case, would have been to say, you know, those things I said I believed in, I don't believe in those anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, thoughts on immigration or Muslim bans or tariffs or whatever, I no longer believe that. And also, that behavior that I said we shouldn't condone, yeah, it's okay with me now.
And
that
would
have been what I had to do, and I just couldn't do it. And,
I mean, really, like, when you say you would have had to have done it, what does that mean? In order to get reelected or—
You know, definitely. I wrote a book as soon as Donald Trump was elected, and it took about 6 months, and it took a while because I didn't tell my staff I was writing it. Yeah. I didn't want them to talk me out of it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't to say, I'm going to write this book
and then
exit.
This was called The Conscience of a Conservative.
Yeah, Stonebury Goldwater's, a line.
Who is the kind of George Washington figure of modern Arizona politics, right? And it was a New York Times bestseller, so.
Well, the purpose of it wasn't to say, well, I'm going to write a book and then retire. I had hoped that I could explain myself and say, here's the conservative principles I believe in. This has been traditional conservatism, limited government, economic freedom, individual responsibility, strong American leadership, not what we're seeing out of the White House now. And I'd hoped that, that Arizona voters, have always supported more independent-minded candidates. That's how I got in the first time. And that's how John McCain and Barry mm-hmm. Goldwater and others have served. But it became clear by October of 2017 that the voters in Arizona, now that, let me qualify this, that subset of a subset mm-hmm. of a subset that votes, you know, regularly in Republican primaries, mm-hmm. they wanted somebody who was all in with the president.
Yeah.
And in order, and I could have flipped and said, oh, I'm right with the president yeah. now. But it just, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I had to face my kids at home. I had to sleep at night, and I.
That's
I,
what I boarding school is for, yeah. right? You know, but yeah, and you Maybe had so. Around the you know along this time, and you had been elected to the Senate in 2012. So this is still part of the Tea Party wave. You've been in Congress for a dozen years before that, known as a a small government. You were, pork barrel spending was a huge part of your agenda, cutting that. But you had said, you know, you're pro-free markets, limited governments, free trade, pro-immigration. And you said, you know, back then, I'm not sure that there's room in the Republican Party for that kind of person.
Yeah.
How did Trump turn the Republican Party inside out? Because, you know, this is, if you go back to, what, 94, when the Republicans took the House and the Senate for the first time, you know, in a million years. And that was their agenda. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you flash forward, a decade plus later, and, you know, the Tea Party was all about, we are going to stop spending. Right. We don't care about social issues. We're taxed enough already. Mm-hmm. We want to cut spending. Yeah. And it brought in, you know, you were already in Congress, but it brought you to the Senate. It brought in people like, you know, Rand Paul and Thomas Massey and Justin Amash. You know, how did Trump flip that in? You know, it seemed like in a matter of months.
Yeah, and that disturbed me. Yeah. And I knew that it wasn't, I called it a fever back then, mm-hmm. that this fever will have to break. Yeah. It's been a longer fever than I had hoped. But ultimately, I do think the Republican Party will need to return, should return, be good for the country to return to that. We certainly have, just take limited government in terms of government spending. President Trump has been right to ridicule other, you know, Democratic presidents and Democratic mm-hmm. Congresses for spending too much. But boy, look at this. We're breaking records now.
Yeah, yeah.
This big, beautiful bill was big, big, certainly, and expensive. So on those things, and then, you know, strong American leadership abroad and mm-hmm. value in alliances, we just kind of thrown all that aside. And I said at that time, and I've said this, and many people who are now even in President Trump's cabinet or right along with him said that someday we Republicans will wake mm-hmm. up and say, we did this for this man.
Yeah.
And I do think that will come because, you know, grievance and anger are not a governing philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can win elections, a time or two, but at some point you have to govern. And, you know, you mentioned we're bumping up against a government shutdown. That's not mm-hmm. new. This has happened a lot over the past couple of decades, but we don't even seem to be trying to come to some agreement. We're just putting out mean tweets.
And I want to, you know, point out your bona fides about limited government. You voted against the Troubled Asset Relief Program in 2008, which was happening at the end of the Bush administration. And then it passed and it got picked up and expanded by Obama. But I can remember a reason at the time our offices were near DuPont Circle, and we were watching that in the office on C-SPAN, the vote, and it looked like, of course, TARP was going to pass, and it was really heavily pushed. McCain was in favor of it. Bush certainly was, and it tallied, and then suddenly it lost on its first vote. And you are in favor of a more limited government, a smaller government. The news site, it's defunct now, 538, that did data journalism. They noted that as of December of 2018, kind of right at the end mm-hmm. of your term in the Senate, that you had voted 85% with Trump or with the Republican Party. So you were not, like some crazy out of line person. What were the, what were the votes and positions that you took that angered Trump so much?
Well, I think any vote you take that doesn't, go along with him, he gets upset about. But I suppose that the first time I met him was, I'd never gone to New York to try to raise money from him. I didn't like his position back in 2012 when he said that Barack Obama, wasn't a legitimate president because he was born in Kenya. Right. I knew that he didn't, believe that, but he knew some people would and used that.
I also never understood that because, okay, if he's born in Kenya, but his mother is an American citizen, it's a weird, like a very lazy argument.
Yeah, but he's used that. Yeah. Tried to use it on Ted Cruz and others.
Alberta Ted.
Yeah. So, I'd never cottoned to his kind of style of politics. Right. So I'd never met him. But when he came to a Republican Senate luncheon off campus, it was a campaign thing. He pointed his finger at me and said, "You've been critical of me." Hmm. And I said, "Yeah, I have." And I said, "The things you were saying about Hispanics in Arizona and about immigration aren't good."
Yeah.
And I said, by the way, I'm the other senator from Arizona, the one that wasn't captured. And the things you said about John McCain are vile. Yeah. And that's wrong. And And he looked at me and said, and pointed at me and said, "You're going to lose in November."
Yeah.
I reminded him I wasn't up in November, but I'd had another, 2 years. Yeah. But anyway, so I think he was not disposed to support me anyway. But I truly, people often ask, "Are you a never Trumper?" I, like I said, I have never voted for him. Didn't support him in 16 or 20 or 24. But there was, after he won in 16, there was a glimmer of hope for the night when he gave his acceptance speech. I thought that was magnanimous and maybe he'll now turn. Maybe we can chalk this all up to campaign stuff and he'll govern differently. But that went away pretty quickly.
Yeah. And he announced and put in various versions of it, all of which ended up kind of getting overruled by courts, but bans on immigrants or Muslims, but ultimately immigrants from Muslim majority countries.
Yeah.
What was wrong about that? And I realize that's a kind of bizarre statement to say, but can you unpack the logic of what is wrong with that?
Sure. The way he presented it in December of 2015 on the campaign trail, he called it a Muslim ban.
Yeah.
And that means you're banning people who practice a particular religion from entering the country.
Yeah.
And if you ban them from coming in the country, what can you do to those who are here as well? Mm-hmm. We believe in religious freedom. It's part of the First Amendment. That's what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
And, I come from, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mm-hmm. And in the past, we have been persecuted. Mm-hmm. And the way I looked at it was, if you can go after Muslims, you can go after Mormons.
Yeah.
And so that weekend that he made that statement, I went to a mosque with my family and at Friday prayers and actually gave a speech titled "Mormons and Muslims and What We Have in Common and or the Differences," but that we are welcoming and that we believe in religious freedom and liberty. So that was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
And later on there were different iterations of it from minority Muslim countries or majority Muslim countries, and you had different restrictions. And you can do that legally, and if you can find that they aren't actually following rules that we have to have for immigration. But a Muslim ban is particularly egregious.
Yeah. You brought up immigration. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that was definitely one of your signature issues, both in the House as well as in the Senate. There was a time not so long ago when the Republican Party was, both parties have mixed records on immigration. Mm-hmm. But the Republican Party, there was a large chunk of Republicans who were in favor of, more legal immigration.
Yeah.
And cutting down on illegal immigration. But, the way you do that basically is by making it easier to come here legally, right?
Definitely.
What, what's the case, what's your basic case for immigration, for more legal immigration? And what happened to the Republican Party where now, it's— it's kind of like trying to find a pro-choice Republican. Yeah. You cannot find a pro-immigrant Republican anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm here from Arizona, mm-hmm. and I grew up on a farm in northern Arizona. We made use of Mexican migrant labor that would come. I believe at that time, you know, I was just a kid on a farm, but I don't think it was illegal to hire. It was illegal for their presence.
Right.
But we had people, and there was almost a cat and mouse game played mm-hmm. by the Border Patrol. They didn't really patrol the border. Mm-hmm. People would come across that frequently, but they would raid farms and ranches mm-hmm. and then take them back across the border, and they'd promptly come back. And we had one of our workers I've written about who came, I think 19 times he was taken back mm-hmm. by the Border Patrol, and they didn't keep records really. Right. So,
But those are exactly the stories now that, you know, Republicans and people, you know, on social media and whatnot will be like, oh yeah, that guy, he's been kicked out of the country 19 times. Like, we got to build a wall. Yeah. We got to arrest them. We got to send them to El Salvador.
Yeah. Well, I wrote about this guy, Manuel Chaitis, who had worked on our farm for 24 years. In the process, he got a green card, mm-hmm. raised a family in my hometown, 6 kids, adopted a few, just a stellar citizen. And he came to work. And our country is better because of him. Mm-hmm. And we you know, kind of with a wink and a nod, we knew we needed labor, so we just didn't enforce mm-hmm. The border much. Now, given where we are today, we can't do that, obviously. Mm-hmm. You have the entire world wants to come here, mm-hmm. and you have people who are coming in who will do us harm, and we have to guard against that. We need strong borders where, you know, back in the past, we could do different things then. So I'm completely on board. And the bill that I helped write in 2013 as part of the Gang of Eight, four Republicans, four Democrats in the Senate, that passed the Senate 68-32, that had $40 billion designated for border protection, which was more than anything up to this last, I think, big, beautiful bill. It insane amounts for border protection, and it was needed. But it was insane, you know, given what was spent there before. But it also had a mechanism to deal with those who were here illegally now, mm-hmm. who needed to be regularized or deported. Yeah. And there was a mechanism there. It dealt with the so-called Dreamers, mm-hmm. the DACA students. Right.
And those are people who were brought here by their parents as children. So they're here in the country. They're not technically legal, but they're also not to blame for being here.
That's right. And that's, you know, we could have, and the sad thing is, we could have dealt with that population. There was broad mm-hmm. political support among Republicans and Democrats for, mm-hmm. You know, from 2000 up to about 2015 or so. Mm-hmm. But we always thought, well, let's attach that with some other issues. Right. That are more difficult and mm-hmm. and use that to get the others and try to do comprehensive reform, and it just never worked. But and we also need more immigration, high skilled and so-called low skilled, or those who are just coming here who will work. Yeah. And it needs to be legal, and there needs to be a legal pathway, but that needs to be a bigger pathway.
Right.
So what
turned, excuse me, among Republicans? You mentioned you were part of the Gang of Eight. You know, your former Senate colleague, John McCain, was a longtime supporter of immigration, although in 2008, when he was running for president, he kind of threw that out for an ad where he was like, build the damn wall. Yeah. But, you know, there was a proud tradition. Yeah. Ronald Reagan, you know, passed immigration reform, the last comprehensive bill in the late 80s. And, you know, in 1980, a reason we run this a couple times a year, there's a clip from a 1980 presidential debate in Houston between George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan. They're the last two guys running for the Republican nomination. And they are outdoing themselves to say what they will do to welcome illegal immigrants in America because, you know, they're part of the labor force and they come here and they make families and they make the next great generation of Americans. Like, when I look at that, it is like looking at a newsreel from the lost island of Atlantis or something. Like, just in your political career in the last few years, and, you know, things change. Like, what happened to Republicans?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, of necessity, it's changed. Mm-hmm. And I agree with the change. And like I said, it used to be that the nature of immigration was mostly Mexican immigrants who had come across, work in some kind of program, and then return, and they wouldn't bring their families. They would just be seasonal workers. And because the border was easy to cross, then we started beefing up the border, and they figured, well, if I'm going to come across, I don't want to have to go back and cross it again.
It's an unintended consequence so when you harden the border.
And then the costs and everything. Yeah. And then later on, with you know, air travel and everything easier, and other countries being, you know, with economic despair and whatnot, it has just sent a whole new crowd of people who it just, the nature has changed, and it's just overwhelmed the border. And so even if we had Republicans who said, you know, we need more immigration, whatever, we now need serious border protection. And so I understand that. What I don't understand among Republicans now is, all right, let's, you've got the border under control, and President Trump, I give him credit for doing that. Now let's talk about what we really need here, and we need bigger pathways. But you know, imposing $100,000 fee on H-1B visas isn't probably the best thing. So and that's what's been disturbing. So I understand where Republicans have changed, if you will, on immigration and what we need at the border. I'm one of those. It's because the nature of immigration has changed. But this kind of anti-immigration strain, I don't understand.
And do you feel like it is part, and I hadn't thought of this until you were talking, because, you know, your other issues, your pro-free market, your pro-free trade, these are things that part of a Republican catechism that are no longer in favor or even mentioned. You know, in a way, it seems like the Republican Party, even though, you know, they own the White House, they own the House, they own the Senate, they're the party of decline. And they're saying, well, you know, these people coming across the border are taking our jobs. You know, goods that come into the country are taking our, you know, our production capacity. I mean, is there a connection between becoming anti-immigrant and becoming anti-free trade?
Yes, there is. And on the anti-free trade thing, that is just baffling as well. This notion that we have to put up protectionist barriers, just like, you know, immigration barriers. And that's just not right. If we're going to put up immigration barriers, we better do a lot more in terms of trade barriers to make it more free trade, or we will decline, because that's what happened. Protectionism leads to decline. Less productivity, you get flabby when you put up protectionist barriers that protect your industry. That's just what happens. And tariffs are inflationary. And tariffs, you know, there are some good reasons for tariffs. If we want to go after China for stealing intellectual property, or we're worried about them, their growing military or whatever, by all means, that's where you use tariffs. But if you're going to do that, you better have the rest of the world with you. You better have your allies with you if you're going to confront a challenge that big. And that's what I just, there's no coherence to this, you know, tariff policy or protectionist policy, other than, you know, trying to please one group or another. And then you try to please one group, like farmers the other day. The president said, well, we're going to use this money from tariffs to, you know, subsidize some farmers more because
China
lost markets.
China closed their soybean market, which literally happened in Trump's first term as well. He put tariffs on Chinese goods. They say, okay, go sell your soybean somewhere else. So he gives them a subsidy. He's doing it again.
No, it happens all over. In Turkey, where I was, we've imposed Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs. So Turkey, like any country, retaliated, and they cut off importation of farm goods. And that costs American farmers about $500 million a year. Just that one country, one market, just because of retaliatory tariffs. So these tariffs aren't imposed in a vacuum. They show up somewhere else, not just in the higher price of goods.
You're of course mentioning or on the fly, you were an ambassador, the ambassador to Turkey under Joe Biden. I want to get to that in a second, but if we can stay a little bit on the kind of free trade tariffs, immigrant. You know, you represented Arizona. You grew up here. You live here. You also spend time in Utah. These are two booming states. Is the fear about the decline of America's economy and the fear about immigration, is that present here, or is that more, is it you know, the old kind of post-industrial Midwest, you know, where people have been leaving, jobs have been leaving. Right. You know, is it a regional thing or is it a is it larger than that?
I would say we're better off and have a little different attitude than those in the Rust Belt. But this kind of attitude among Republicans and its political expression is about the same. It's hard to find, you know, those here Republicans sounding much different than somebody from Indiana or elsewhere, because you, right now in this atmosphere, you're where the president is, wherever he is, all the time. And so, but there should be, you know, less concern, I guess, about free trade, because yes, we're doing well here. We're growing. Arizona is growing. Utah is growing. The Intermountain West. A lot of these states are doing great, and that's what is so bothersome about this rhetoric about all these countries in the world ripping us off. You know, we built this rules-based international order that is composed of security alliances and trade programs and preferential trade in some cases to build certain countries. Those countries have benefited, but we have benefited enormously in terms of having access to their markets. And so that's what's just bothersome is about this, talking down and like we've been taken advantage of, playing the victim here.
Yeah, so this goes back to that grievance politics. And it's odd because Donald Trump, you know, who kind of, you could say he, you know, he was born on third base. He was born like 10 feet away from home plate, really, you know, when you get down to it, but has a lot of grievances, right? You know, your interest in kind of global trade and internationalism dates back at least to when you were doing your mission as a LDS member. You were in South Africa and was it Rhodesia or Rwanda?
It was Zimbabwe at that time, just after Rhodesia.
And then you also spent time in Namibia, right? As they were separating from South Africa. Can you, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, that kind of internationalism, like somehow you, you know, you're invested in a global identity rather than an American identity. And that, you know, people who grow up in Namibia or South Africa or Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, you know, Africa, any of the countries, they really can't be American or we don't have anything in common with them. You know, how did you walk away with a different understanding of that?
It's interesting. I mean, it was an eye-opener for me. I grew up in Snowflake, Arizona, a small, you know,
I'm guessing,
down on a cattle ranch.
That's probably a pretty white place, as white as snowflakes, except for the Mexicans, right?
So I, you know, went to South Africa and Zimbabwe, and it was a big eye-opener for me to get out in the world. And I came back just with a huge interest and love for the African continent and interest in its politics. But later on, and bringing America into this and why we should care about my wife and I, after I graduated from college and went to Washington, D.C. for a couple of years, I went to the country of Namibia, where they were implementing UN Security Council Resolution 435. Now, some people point to the UN and say it's completely worthless. This is one thing that works. It was a Security Council resolution that was implemented to give Namibia independence from South Africa. Namibia's election happened the same week the Berlin Wall came down, November of 1989. And I watched the Namibian people who had been in exile, that had come back to write their constitution, have their first elections. And I watched them, you know, write their constitution. We actually brought people over to help in that process. And these people at this time, they weren't looking to, you know, for the strongman model. They wanted a separation of powers. They wanted what we had. And they looked and revered you know, the U.S. Constitution. And that time, I remember clearly, the most vivid memory, I think, of that time was watching or listening, reading later, Vaclav Havel, then the president of Czechoslovakia, speaking before the U.S. Congress. That was long before I was in Congress. And I just remember crying when I read that. I read his words about how much they valued the United States for its example, its morality, and its you know, commitment to freedom, its soft power that buoyed him up in prison imprisoned by the communists. And countries all over the world at that time were, springing up, looking at the United States as an example.
Yeah.
And that really kind of motivated me.
And when you were in Congress and the Senate, you also pushed to normalize trade with Cuba, or relations with Cuba.
Yeah.
Excuse me. That's drawn from the same thing you one of the career highlights of my life is, going to Havana with you and a bunch of people. You tell a great story from Lech Walesa, Walesa, the great Polish freedom fighter, who was, when he heard that like Americans weren't allowed to travel to Cuba, he was like, "What are you guys doing? Can you recount that?"
Yeah, that was interesting. I was on a CODEL, the congressional delegation, with Henry Hyde, who was chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee at that time, and others. We went to Poland and went to Gdansk and met with Lech Walesa. He was not president at the time. He'd finished his term, but he said, I remember, all of a sudden, he just broke from the other issues we were talking about. He said, "I just don't, excuse me, I don't understand your policy on Cuba." He said, "You have a museum of socialism 90 miles from your shore, and you won't let anybody go see it."
Yeah.
And that's, kind of what has motivated me on Cuba that whole time. Yeah. I tried for, 18 years in Congress to lift the travel ban. We got quite a ways to doing that, make travel pretty regular. But my motivation was, if you want to get rid of communism, if you want to bedevil the Castro brothers, make a deal with spring break once or twice, just overwhelm them. And I think that the Cubans have played our policy like a fiddle, the Cuban government, in staying in power, because they have an advantage that no other foreign government has, is to just to export their opposition when they get to, they just export them. So, but they, if we
then
would just
ironically, they come to, oftentimes South Florida, and then they are like, don't normalize relations
completely
with Cuba. And that regime there is terrible, which they are, but it's like,
So some of them very much opposed to it. And for a long time too, it's kind of a cottage industry in Miami, opposition to Cuba and to use the policy with programs like radio and TV Marti and a lot of spending on this policy, which just perpetuates it.
Right.
And so here we are 60 some years later and still communist government in Cuba.
And one of the longest running, pure protectionist programs have to do with sugar subsidies in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because Cuba is a big producer of sugar. So we got to keep that out.
Yeah. So I think the better way would have been long ago, which is just throw it open, let Americans go. I just thought if there is not a good national security reason for Americans not to travel, then they should be able to travel.
Yeah.
That's what motivated me.
Do you? This is a very boomer question that I'm about to ask you. And we're both, we were both born at the tail end of the baby boom. Yeah. But, as horrible as communism was, international communism, and we grew up at the tail end of the Cold War, really, but there was like, okay, this is a twilight struggle, and there's a system of free enterprise and individual freedom, and then there's one of command economies and repression. Is part of the bizarre lack of focus in American politics is that communism is dead, and we don't remember the lessons enough to understand that, we're not going to become communists, whether Mamdani wins or Trump expands the presidency. But, do we need to do a better job of remembering the recent past?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. And I think, as Republicans, we see some of the policies that we're kind of accepting now that we would have completely rejected a few years ago. Government taking a stake in Intel, company or other
golden
companies.
Shares and 10%
that's just
cuts of NVIDIA or whatever. Every export, you got to drop a dime in in Trump's butt.
Well, that is what we Republicans have always stood against, but somehow we accept. And so, I think we have too short a memory sometimes.
Yeah. You served under Joe Biden. You were ambassador to Turkey for a couple of years. Did you get that job partly because you publicly endorsed Biden over Trump in 2020?
You know, I probably wouldn't have got it without that. Yeah. But that wasn't my motivation in endorsing Joe Biden, believe me. But I, you know, everybody thought if I, you know, did an ambassadorship, it would be to South Africa or Zimbabwe or somewhere where I'd been, and that would have been great. But I thought, and I told the White House, I'll consider something, but only if it's a really consequential country.
Yeah.
And they overshot the mark.
Okay. Yeah. So Turkey is a fascinating country because Erdogan is a strong man, increasingly authoritarian over his time in power. Turkey, you know, going back to the Cold War, is like arguably the greatest NATO ally that the U.S. had. Yeah. I mean, they did everything that we asked of them during the Cold War, putting their own population at risk, and, you know, and they're sandwiched between the Soviet Union and Turkey and Iran. I mean, they. What was it like being in Turkey? And, you know, how important is Turkey to maybe not American hegemony, but to a kind of stable world order?
Oh, good point. Napoleon is rumored to have said, I don't know if he really said it, but he said if the world were one country, Istanbul would be its capital. Yeah. It is right in the smack in the middle of everything. And you look at it now with Ukraine, Russia going at it just north. Armenia, Azerbaijan, kind of settled now, to the east, Iran there, and then you've got Syria directly to the south, and Gaza just below it. They are right in the middle of it. And so to be there when 6 weeks after I arrived, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Yeah.
And then Turkey, you know, which was important before, is increasingly important. They control the Turkish Straits, the only access into the Black Sea. And Turkey immediately, within 5 days, invoke the Montreux Convention, which gave them the ability to deny Russians access to the Black Sea with their warships. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people thought this war is going to be over in a couple of days and Russia won't need it anyway. And maybe that's how the Turks justified it early on. But that turned out to be an extremely consequential decision, a big one, and that Turkey stood out and stood for the West and stood for NATO. And you're right, they've been a valued member of NATO for 74 years. And before that, they were beside us in Korea.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they've been good allies there.
Did they extract, what did they get for, holding the Black Sea?
Oh, no, nothing. They have been foursquare in favor of Ukraine's sovereignty. Obviously, they're careful in their pronouncements and what they say because Russia is right next door. They have a history of Russia invading, and Russia can control a lot of their, you know, the oil exports, natural gas, and immigration issues from Syria when Russia was deep there. So there's a lot that Russia can do to Turkey. And so this has been at great cost to them, but they have come out, and every pronouncement they make is foursquare in favor of Ukraine's sovereignty. And they have backed it up by, you know, exporting a lot of drones, commercial ventures, but also helping us on other areas as well.
What is the case? You know, I have to admit, I am, as a diehard libertarian, I was hoping that NATO would be disbanded when the Soviet Union collapsed, or at least let's put a rider on everything. Like, what is our function? What is our purpose? Why is it important to, that Ukraine maintain its independence, for America?
I think if Ukraine doesn't, if Russia marches through, they don't stop there. Mm-hmm. And that affects the whole of Europe. And and that is not good for the United States. So to have Russia's gain is really, that is kind of a zero sum there, given where they are. So yeah, it's extremely important. Mm-hmm. And the issue that I spent most of my time on, if there's one issue while I was in Turkey, was trying to get Sweden and Finland into NATO over Turkey's objection.
Turkey. Had Why didn't real, Turkey want Sweden or Finland?
Turkey had mostly with Sweden, but real objections to Sweden's treatment of the PKK, a terrorist organization that we consider terrorists. Everybody does.
Yeah. And are Kurdish nationalists or separatists.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Sweden was too tolerant of them, allowing them to come in and fundraise. Yeah. And so in the end, Sweden had to amend their constitution. Mm-hmm. And then enact some laws, and so they had to do some real things. But Turkey had to, get over it with Sweden, and that was difficult. That was a hard sell to the Turkish people. If anything unites the Turks, it's hatred for the PKK.
Oh, I thought you were going to add Swedes. We all hate Swedes, right? Except for, you know,
also, we needed to sell F-16s to Turkey to keep them interoperable with NATO. They needed more. They have the second largest military in NATO. And so in the end, it was one big deal, if you will, with U.S. F-16s, Sweden getting into NATO, Turkey approving it.
This sounds like the Baltimore Orioles, Cincinnati Reds, a couple other swaps. Out of this, you got a knighthood in Sweden, right?
Well, that was a great honor. My heritage is Swedish.
Do you wear that around the neighborhood? And
My wife just asked, does that come with an IKEA discount or something?
Yeah, or like a golden hex screw,
Went to Sweden a few months ago, and I didn't get any treatment like that. So.
All right. Well, it's very egalitarian. Right? So, even doesn't that, like the king walks around in a windbreaker or something like that. Going back to Trump, his foreign policy, he definitely has a very different approach to American foreign policy. There's no question America runs the world, according to him. But then he has, his Ukraine position seems to be shifting after basically blaming Zelensky for Putin invading Ukraine. I mean, which, again, whatever you think of the sides of those words, the description of basic reality is disturbing, to say the least. But Trump has done some good things in foreign policy, don't you think? I mean, making the NATO countries pay more. Yeah. He seems maybe to be on the brink of helping to ease the war in Gaza and between Israel and Gaza. The Abraham Accords were, I think, almost everybody would agree those were a good thing. Is there a way for America to maintain a positive position in the role of maintaining stability and hegemony, or not hegemony, but stability and hopefully expanding, things like democratic governance and individual rights and free trade and things like that without us being the world's policeman?
Yeah, I would argue. I mean, like you pointed out, there are a couple of things. President Trump's insistence that NATO, that NATO countries pull their weight. There are a number of them that needed to spend more. It's not money going into NATO. It's just spending on their own defense, which they need to. The Abraham Accords, great stuff. I'm glad to see him shifting in favor of Ukraine. So I applaud that. And with Syria. He jumped out quickly and said, let's recognize this new government and hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. Other administrations may not have done that. Yeah. It was a difficult move, but it was the right one. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that everything he does is wrong. There is something to, the old Nixon madman theory. If somebody fears you and doesn't know what you'll do, that's an advantage. And it can be, but behind it, you need some kind of coherent philosophy or something you're trying to achieve. And I would still argue that, most of the world right now, they are, not waiting for the U.S. like they used to. And I'll just give one example. I was in Geneva, Switzerland, a few months ago, met with an old European ambassador that I knew that was there at, the UN in Geneva. And he said, we used to wait for the U.S. to take a position before we took our position. Mm-hmm. Because we wanted to follow what the U.S. was doing. He said, now we don't care. We just go ahead. And that was disturbing to me because these international rules and norms are created whether we're in the room or not. Yeah. And if we're not, then it's China and Russia and others having greater influence. And so we can't just toss that aside and say we're only going to focus on this and we can't offend our allies in a way that they'll move on without us. And that's a concern.
Yeah. You've been present for political violence. We're kind of in a moment. It's not fully clear that political violence is rising, but there have definitely been, episodes of this. There are people shooting up ICE offices, the assassination of Charlie Kirk on a Utah community college. You were at the congressional softball game practice for Steve Scalise.
Baseball.
By the way, what position were you playing? I'm just curious.
third base for years and okay. center field.
So you got wheels for that, right? and a cannon, I guess, as an arm. But you were there for the Scalise shooting in 2017, yeah. and that turned out to be a, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at with, you know, are we, how worried should we be, do you think, about political violence? And,
yeah.
And does political violence come from particular ideologies, or is it something that is kind of the work of madmen, and hence we need to discourage it, but we also have to make sure that we're not using it as a pretext to kind of squash particular points of view?
Yeah, I do think it'd be tough to argue that it's not on the rise, given just in the last couple of years, the number of, horrible incidents where elected officials, in Minnesota, for example, Gabby Giffords, was here in Arizona years ago.
And by the way, in the Minnesota shooting, and let me put you on the spot, because I'm assuming you're friendly with Mike Lee, but he responded to that. He's a Republican who, another Tea Party guy who, when the state politician in Minnesota was killed, he tweeted out like horrible, bad jokes. Is that what you're talking about? Where like even people like Mike Lee start
I think it's all of our responsibility to mourn with those who mourn.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine, poking fun or anything at any of these instances. But I do think it's on the rise, and I do think that the language that politicians use will. I mean, mostly the heightened rhetoric where those who disagree with you or those who are in the other party are not just wrong, they're evil. Mm-hmm. And calling them fascists or communists or whatever else. And that goes, like I've said, those terms have been used to describe people in both parties. But using that kind of language gives a madman or people who are not... Are not right. Some excuse they feel. Mm-hmm. If somebody's evil, then I'm justified in going after them. And in my case, I was on that baseball field, and then later, during the last couple of months of my Senate term, during the Kavanaugh hearings and whatnot, we actually had a man go to a church that he thought I was at. And looking for me, and he had a gun charge against him, but he'd been to a rally the day before where he got, heard my name and got riled up, and he ended up going to several churches that day looking for me he had some kind of scope that he was trying to find me, and then who knows. But that just, when people hear that, they think I'm entitled, I can do this. And that's what the responsibility is on elected officials and prominent other people in politics to tone it down.
Yeah. How, you said you're not going to be complicit. You're going back to your plow, you're Cincinnatus, right? Or whoever. I don't even know.
Cincinnatus
is George Washington's horse. So what are its steps? Like, how do we get out of this moment where, the parties are less secure than ever? They have, fewer and fewer people want to be called a Republican or a Democrat when anonymous people poll them. Even then, I don't want to be either. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of rapprochement. Biden... spent a lot of time and people in the Democratic Party spent a lot of time going after Trump when he was out of office. Trump is obviously targeting people, and you can take it back before that. What are ways to move forward to a more functional system, and not one so that, the government is passing even bigger bills with, 90% margins, but what do we do?
Yeah, well, in terms of institutional reforms, that may be what you're asking. There are some reforms that I do support, and some that are in train, around the country. Alaska, a while ago, put in what they call top five and then ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
I like both, but the more important part was the top five, where if we, got parties out of the business of being able to control ballot access. Mm-hmm. Because then that subset of a subset of a subset is who controls. And what it means here in Arizona Arizona is still a red state, but we have a Democratic governor, two Democratic senators, Democratic attorney general, superintendent of public instruction, Democrat. Secretary of State, Democrat.
Biden won the state in 2020. Yeah. I mean, Trump won in 2016 and 2024, but like... Arizona is one of the most Republican states in the country. And if it's not overflowing with Republicans, something's going wrong.
Because I think that it's because that subset of a subset of a subset is able to control who gets on the ballot.
Yeah.
And once we do that in Alaska, take that, for example, Lisa Murkowski is very conservative. I mean, by all realistic measures, she is. Except that of agreeing too much with the president, and which she doesn't, which would mean that she couldn't get through a Republican primary. But under their system, she can.
Right.
And if you had
Can I push on that for a second, though? Because that's also Sarah Palin seemed to be poised to be the member of Congress from Arizona, from Alaska, rather. And she won, I guess, in the first round of voting and then ended up losing, right? They ended up sending a Democrat to Congress.
Yeah.
Won't people feel really pissed if, you know, somebody, you know, you go through the first round of voting and you get 43% of the vote and then you go to the second round and like you're out?
I like ranked choice because it pushes the extremes away on the left and the right. And so I don't know if she can blame her loss on that. But what it does do is it allows the top two or top three in Alaska, it's top five, to get through that process that the state pays for, but the parties have traditionally controlled. So I think that what it would mean in Arizona is we'd be electing more Republicans. because it's just...
It would also reflect the population more.
Yes.
I think California has like top two.
Top
right?
two.
Which is no good. I have to say, as somebody, I don't think I've ever belonged to a political party, but I know, you know, in the California governor's race, it means, you know, I want to see the third or fourth party in there to, you know, at least get to the general election so that some people hear their message. And if it was top five, that would be kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Top five's good.
Yeah.
So there are some institutional reforms.
But how do you get those passed? Like, why
It's extremely difficult. Yeah. Alaska barely passed theirs, and then it was almost repealed in this last cycle. So Arizona tried to do a version of that, but it was just very complicated. Yeah, because, I mean, as much as people say that, you know, I don't believe in this party or that, I'm really independent, most people are more partisan than they will poll, I think, in the polls. So that's really difficult to do, but I think it'd be important. I think if you could have another few more independent-minded senators, whether they belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, it would be a good thing. Yeah. It would be a different power center. Institutional reforms are important, but also, people just ought to take their responsibility as an elected official more seriously, as this is a representative democracy, and it's served us well for 250 years, and I think it can go on much longer. I'm optimistic that this fever will ultimately break, and like I said, because we have to govern, and right now we aren't doing much of that.
You know, as a congressman and as a senator, you're uniquely positioned to kind of talk about this, whether it was, you know, W. Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, Trump again, Congress is just prostrate. I've a lot of prostrating. But what is going on? Like, why would you work to get elected to Congress or the Senate and then be like, I'm not going to do anything while I'm here?
The most puzzling thing about all this, I would use the word supine.
That's much better.
It just baffles me that people will completely give away their franchise, whether it's on spending issues more generally, or whether it's on tariff policy. And hopefully we can rely on the courts. We shouldn't have to. Rely on the courts this fall on the tariff issue to say this is clearly the power to tax, and tariffs are tax, belongs to Congress. And I know that many of my former colleagues are, you know, quietly praying that the court will rule that, because they don't want to be supine. But boy, it's painful to watch. Painful to watch that right now. Just Congress. I mean, our system is such that the presidency is going to amass more power all the time. That happens just automatically, given the nature of the system. What is problematic is when Congress, the first branch of government, willingly cedes ground to the administration. And once you do it, it's very difficult to claw it back. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Do you think, you know, this used to be a standard position and reason that divided government was better because it would gridlock. Completely. But then what's happened is, you know, it went from being, you know, a lot of the spending, a lot of federal spending had to be decided every year. It was discretionary. You know, it's defense, it's education, it's 50% of the federal budget. Now it's like only 25% of the federal budget is discretionary. And, you know, that means that Congress, they don't do anything and discretionary spending goes up. We're spending like 50% more than we were in 2019. And entitlement spending just is, you know, rising at its own rate.
No, I do like divided government. That's when Republicans discover our fiscal sanity when there's a Democrat in the White House. And if you look at the last time we had any semblance of a balanced budget, it was when there was divided government. And, and so, that you know, we pendulum swing and we'll get it again. But to your point, the it's entitlement spending. We used to call it that. Now it's just a non-discretionary. It just keeps going up. And I think the only thing that's going to turn it back, you know, back in the 90s, I remember that book, Bankruptcy 1995. Everybody thought, you know, this is it. This is the threshold that we hit it. I think the debt at that time was about $7
trillion. It's like half a day's interest or something.
But we've blown past all of these thresholds that we're supposed to trip us up, largely because we're the world's reserve currency and everything else. But at some point, you'll have a bond auction that doesn't go well, and you know, the scare comes, and then if we're, you know, these other BRICS countries or somebody else decides we're going to go with another currency, and we're no longer the safe refuge, or we're no longer the best house in a bad global neighborhood, then we've got a real, real trouble. I just hope that we decide to tackle it before that crisis.
And do you think that might happen before the Social Security trust funds go busts, or
I mean, which is rapidly approaching.
It's still a few years.
I mean, if we keep adding, you know, what 38 trillion now, and adding,
I think we might
this,
be at 40.
In all likelihood, that could happen before we hit those other problems.
Well, maybe that's good. Then we're going to have to deal with that. I don't know.
But yeah, there is a way out. You know, you and I remember in the 90s and whatever, looking at the so-called Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Finland, you know, Norway, they're the ones, those welfare states. There's no way they'll get their spending under control. And they found a way. But it's usually basically just saying, we can't deal with it politically. Let's have an automatic ticker that just, you know, no matter who's in power, once we hit this threshold, you know, we have cuts or austerity measures or whatever else. And I don't know. So I say, if they fixed it, we can too.
Let's talk about the Institute of Politics at Arizona State. It started this spring. What are you doing here, and what do you hope to achieve?
Well, as soon as I left the Senate, about a semester after, I went to Harvard, their Institute of Politics there, and I saw the value of having an institute on campus that where students can gather and have practitioners, you know, come in and talk to them, and to reinforce the notion that public service, elected office, it's a noble profession, and there are good people in it, and you can find them. And I saw that, but I thought as well, you know, Harvard, those kids going there, they have all the advantages already. They you know, they can have, you know, internships and everything wherever they want to go. But other schools, public schools, in particular in the West, boy, for the most innovative university anywhere is ASU. Mm-hmm. But it has needed an Institute of Politics so people like yourself can come on campus and mingle with the students and have, like you did yesterday, just a one-on-one with, you know, five or six at a time, and to talk about political philosophy. And we're completely nonpartisan, not bipartisan, we're nonpartisan. Yeah. And so I, you know, brought in Mark Cuban last spring to kind of kick it off. And and we had, I think, 4,000 RSVPs for that.
Oh,
and
I can imagine,
a lot of people come. And then,
and he's given out cost plus drugs, things like that, right?
But then I brought Robert O'Brien from the first Trump administration, his national security advisor. He spoke to students here. And then we had Susan Rice, who was President Obama's national security advisor. And so we bring other people in. We'll bring elected officials. Governor Ducey will be here on campus.
He's another Republican casualty of kind of MAGA, right?
Well, he served two terms, and I think he's...
He looked like he was going to be a senator, right?
He was a great governor, and it'll be great to have him on campus meeting with students. And so that's what we want to do, for bringing people on campus, meeting with students as part of our fellows program, but also bringing distinguished speakers. And we just entered into a partnership announced today with a group called Open to Debate. You're familiar with. You've been the moderator. I've done a couple of their debates. They're a nonpartisan debating organization. We'll have our first debate, which will be in a couple of weeks, on birthright citizenship, which is a something the court's likely going to take up. So good timing on that.
Because Lord knows Congress isn't going to do anything
about
it. Right? So, Jeff Flake, thank you so much for talking to Reason.
Hey, thank you for having me. Thanks for being here on campus.